if you're on a brand or if you're in a campaign as a politician where like 90% of your conversation on Twitter is negative, which is always quite possible, then like, what are they being negative about? And is there something you can do about it? So the first thing I would say is like, lean into the bad if that's something that exists. Of course, if there's good, lean into it even more, but don't be afraid to learn what doesn't work, because that can really, really affect not only like content, but it could also affect like messaging at the campaign level for what's important to you.
Welcome to Wave Social Podcast, powered by Arcade Studios. My name's Mike. I'm here with my co-host Mitzi, and we've curated a show for digital marketers, advertisers, and modern entrepreneurs who want to stop chasing the tide and start making waves online.
Each episode, we'll sit down with the tastemakers and strategic minds behind some of the most engaged communities and up-and-coming brands. We'll pull back the curtain on their strategies and experiences to uncover the methodology behind their seismic impact. Thanks for joining us. Let's dive in. Welcome back to another episode of the Wave Social Podcast. Before we get into our interview today, I wanted to tell you about the Wave Social merch that is live now at wavesocialpodcast.com. Go and check it out. Instead of ads this season, we're going to be selling some merch. So we've got a sweater out there, a custom scented candle, lots of really fun goodies for anyone who's making waves.
Yeah, it's good stuff. We had a blast putting together the merch program for Waves this season. Getting into our interview, we've got Andrew Weiss. We're really excited for this conversation. We worked with him on Some Good News. We get to chat with him a little bit about when we all vote. Do you want to just set up who Andrew is, Mitzi?
Yeah, Andrew Weiss, he's an amazing veteran social media marketer. He's got lots of experience. He's worked in agency. He's worked on the brand side. He's worked with some really amazing companies in the past, and he talks about that. I really love that he got into social media before it was like really a big, important part of digital marketing. So he's got lots of experience. I also really learned a lot from him when it comes to looking at data. I know data isn't that exciting sometimes, but the way he kind of like approaches it, it really can be almost like a hack to future success. And I think it's such an important thing that all social media marketers should be paying more attention to beyond just like checking off a box at the end of the month or the week when we're doing our reporting. So it inspired me to kind of dive into data a bit more.
Yeah, it's so easy for social media managers to just float around with vanity metrics, you know, that don't really mean anything. But Andrew really shows us that data can be a source of truth and draw a direct line to impact and revenue and things like that. Beyond Some Good News, we get to chat with him about an interesting project that he was involved in during the election called When We All Vote. There's some incredible statistics there that he boils to the surface for us, even just around how they went after people that were previously uninterested in even participating in the election or voting, which is just really, really interesting to get into. But I think my favorite part, less of the value, but more of just the niche interest, is we get to chat about a specific sneaker project that he was involved in with some Jordan 8s.
And you're going to say that.
Well, it's a highlight.
Yeah, it's cool.
For my sneakerheads out there, get ready. Let's just get into it. Should we read a review and then you can...
kick it off? Let's go.
Cool. Well, I got one from A Vibrant Mind. She says, great conversations with a nice variety of experts, giving a lot of information I may not get to hear as someone working on a smaller team. This has helped me find great people to check out further and learn more from. Yeah, Andrew is one of those people that you get to listen to today. So enjoy and let us know what you think. Andrew, welcome to the show. We're excited to have you.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's going to be really fun. So to get us warmed up and going, why don't you just take us right to the beginning? How did you get into digital marketing and what has your career path looked like so far?
Yeah, absolutely. So I graduated in 2009 and I knew I wanted to get into advertising at the time. And at that point, there were two paths starting to emerge. There was what was now being coined as traditional marketing, and at the time being coined as digital and social. And based off of my age, having a phone, and my interest in social, I was kind of pointed in that direction, not only because it was a, at the time, innovative form of advertising, but also because during the current economy, there were just more job opportunities there. And since then, as social has gone from this appendage towards all other marketing aspects to being one of the first things considered when doing anything, I've luckily evolved my career each time a new platform came, a new opportunity came, whether it was influencer marketing or paid media or what have you, towards what I'm continuing to focus on with my career moving forward.
So I know a little bit about your history, and I wonder if you could talk us through something that you mentioned to us about how you didn't have any internships out of school. So internships are a big way to build a resume. So how did you do that without an internship?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because I had somewhat of an internship experience every year. But what I noticed is, for better or for worse, to be vulnerable for a second, based off where my career was going, they provided very little value whatsoever. And this was at a time when WordPress blogs were becoming something of value. Tumblr was starting to exist as a marketing mechanism. And Twitter and real-time marketing, based off the Oreo moment, were also starting to become a thing. So to show that I was creative, to show that I was able to garner an audience, I started to try to come up with as many Twitter feed opportunities or Tumblr or WordPress blog opportunities that I thought warranted my interests and my ability to create. One of them involved me literally going and taking pictures of my friends' pantries and rating them on a scale of 1 to 10 to try to position it as content marketing and research for food companies. And then another one was about words with friends and the words that were real words in like the dictionary's point of view or in Urban Dictionary and slang point of view, but that weren't accepted by Words with Friends. So it was a bunch of screenshots with witty copy. And then the one that actually really became the focus of my resume to get my internship is the NFL lockout had happened. And there were all these players with nothing to do. And they were tweeting, they were going into movies, they were going into television, they were playing other sports. So I decided to start a Twitter handle where I would become like the quote unquote number one news source for all things during the lockout, and reached out to like various players who were B and C squad players trying to make a name for themselves and asking what they were doing to stay busy while also retweeting updates from various news sources around what they were doing. And that one, luckily for a hot second, picked up some traction. And through all three of those, I built a resume.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's cool to see as we talk with different people about how they got their start and where they innovated and where they had fun. And also, to your point just now, like which projects or which experiments, maybe that would be the better word, actually pick up some traction. But can you talk to us about, after you build that into your resume and going into future opportunities, what was the first opportunity that stuck as far as internships or jobs?
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a social media agency in New York City that I believe was one of the many, I guess, leaders in the space of deciding, all right, well, social media is becoming a thing. And with this thing will be budgets, campaigns, opportunities. And right now that opportunity is Facebook. Obviously, this is hindsight talking, so take it with a grain of salt. But when I started an internship, my first clients, luckily, were Neutrogena, Penguin Publishing, high profile nonprofits that focused on brain cancer. And they're like, all right, well, we have these thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, or if not millions of followers on Facebook. What are we doing here? What do we say to these people? What do we want to talk to them about it? And like, can we make money here? So I got very lucky that my first internship at its time was like developing community guidelines and qualitative research pipelines for beauty companies such as Neutrogena, or can we also ask our fans to come up with different plot lines or different theories about books for Penguin Publishing? And luckily, and this is again hindsight talking, as Facebook evolved, so did Twitter, and so did these brands and how they want to be there. So as long as you were always willing to innovate your job title, your role, and your ability to play in these lanes, you can continue to evolve your career in advertising, because it was really not defined what anyone would be doing. And once it was defined, it probably changed by then already.
That's so interesting that you were on the forefront of an emerging industry, what we now know is social media marketing, and you still are on the outskirts of new approaches in terms of how industries integrate social media into their businesses. And I want to fast forward to one of those new approaches, which is something that we got to work on together, which is Some Good News. We got to work on that last year, which was so fun. And based on the knowledge that you gained over time, what do you think make that project so special in terms of the reach that it had and how it was able to crowdfund all these great stories?
Yeah. So just to backtrack for a quick second, and then it'll show you what I mean by the impact it not only gave me, but others. I would say that whether it was like the emergence of new platforms, the emergence of influencers, the emergence of community management, the emergence of strategy and partnerships, I always had a soft spot for community. I noticed that anything I would ever want at a qualitative research focus group style information, that like community management was kind of driving that. And as long as I presented it in the right way, I could literally be the voice of the community to impact content, partnerships, business objectives, customer service, you name it. So I always tried to stay true to that, but I never really had the opportunity to work in an industry such as not only entertainment, but also entertainment in the form of Some Good News, where it went hand in hand with everything and everyone on the team was aligned with its importance. Because I just distinctively remember it was like my second day and I hadn't really been introduced to you guys yet other than like, hi, my name's Andrew. Hi, my name's Mike. Hi, my name's Mitzi. And I was like, okay, things can always get very ambiguous with like who does what, especially when we're moving so quickly. And the first thing I did before I even decided maybe where I would or would not contribute is I saw that people were sending us good news by the tenfold. And that is just such an amazing opportunity to have when your fan base is committed to providing you, whether it's inspiration or research indirectly. So I knew right away that whether it was myself or you guys doing anything, or whether it was John's team or Made In Network doing anything, that like we already had achieved what like a lot of brands wanted to achieve, which is a rabid community. And when I really dove into it, I saw that what I thought was a lucky to have situation, it was actually like an overwhelmingly powerful amount of information coming our way. And when I got to better understand what you guys wanted to do, and when I saw where I could provide value from a reporting and analytics standpoint, that it was just perfect because it was a full-time job analyzing this community. I mean, we had millions and millions of fans overnight, and all of them were sending us news. DMs on Instagram, private messages on Facebook, DMs on Twitter, at mentions on Twitter, hashtags. I mean, it was coming in from all angles. And it was a really exciting way to turn it into content, partnerships, and then eventually episode development. And because of how many people contributed to it, we could measure what was really trending and what wasn't, so that whenever anyone watched an episode, they felt like they participated in it. And that was really cool because we had 3 to 4 days a week to come up with an episode. And we thankfully had a community that got us there.
Definitely. And I think just to kind of dig into what made it special, I think it was so interesting that the audience was that engaged from the very beginning. And the easy one to point to is the celebrity factor of John, but also just the time can't be overlooked at the top of the pandemic, being a source of hope when everyone needed it. So I think there's a lot of factors that went into it. And people say lightning doesn't strike twice. Maybe it could, but it was really cool to be together, the three of us and our teams working in this moment in time when it made such a difference. But can you talk to us a little bit about how you built out systems and the processes you used to track engagement, specifically with Some Good News? You did a lot of things, but that was really a core part of what you did that made all the difference, especially when it came to brand partnerships and stuff like that.
Yeah. I will say that we were moving so quickly that it took me a hot second to like really grab the wheel to find out what we were working with. I remember it was like my second or third day, and it was like a Thursday. So by the time I had started the third episode had already been almost finished. And we were just looking to fill segments based off of like already existing themes and what the community would give us. So I distinctively remember when it was time for someone to say, hey, we're doing a sports themed episode and we would like to focus on X. And I remember going into the community and finding Y, the answer to X, almost immediately. So that was the first thing I noticed, is that like we already had a community that was providing us with what we needed, and it could impact the episode. And then even more specifically, when we did call outs, they gave us literally what we wanted based off of what they were doing that day or what they had done previously during the pandemic. So what I decided to do after the third episode is I'm going to go study like 500 news submissions from our fans and like figure out like what are these themes. And the themes were very explicit, and they became how we measured content across social, because I was doing the analytics at the time. And it became how I showed segment insights to John, being like, hey, as long as we cover two out of these four themes, then like everyone will feel that they've been brought along for the ride. And it was true, because what we saw is almost all of them involved being bored at home, charity and doing good, recovery, which was like recovery could be in the form of your own personal struggles or, you know, recovering from the pandemic, and then just overall good news. And then that affected partnerships and how I positioned partnerships to Lars and his efforts, where I like basically, for better or for worse, indirectly decided that like, here is how you can view it from a day-to-day content, from a partnership strategy creatively or episode segment. And because that helped me analyze content, it just helped me analyze trends within each segment immediately. And I just started bubbling those up and sharing them with everyone. But in a parallel path, Mitzi and I and her team are all looking for themes under that anyways, and we were just being guided by it. And luckily, the community was responding accordingly. So what I realized is, okay, I could either ask for a vendor right now, which I didn't think was going to be worth our time because it sometimes can take weeks to get a vendor up and ready, or I could just start building what I think everyone might need in a Google Sheet, share it with everyone, ask if it's good enough or not, and just update it over time. And if we end up getting a vendor, so be it. But then as I communicated more and more with everyone and found out what they needed, we just did the rawest form of building a dashboard within Google Sheets. And I had like an inventory of all of our data, but then I tailored specific tabs towards what everyone needed. So we had a tab for sourcing stories. We had a tab for Lars to go do what he needed to do. And then I had a separate tab based off of PR for each episode. And then another tab based off of like what I wanted to pitch to John and his team. It wasn't pretty, but it was a Google Sheet that I think we all eventually became very accustomed to using 24/7.
No kidding. And I think you make such a good point, because, you know, when you're managing a community of that size, and like you said, moving really, really fast, some veteran social media marketers might stop in their tracks and insist on looking for a vendor or some sort of platform to help them schedule posts or a tool for social listening or whatever. But there's so much you can do as long as you're innovative and creative with just a Google Sheet or a Google Doc. And you really pioneered that for our team. And it was so efficient. It was great for the production team, for the editors, for everyone. And we actually did a Clubhouse chat recently about the making of SGN. And it turned into like a testimonial about Google and Google Sheets and Google Docs, because we relied on those sheets so much.
Yeah, I think the moral of the story is just that, like you said, Andrew, it doesn't have to be pretty as long as it's meaningful.
Yeah. And I'll say, for the longest time, and it still happens, a lot of these vendors are, and I'm not knocking them, but they can be quite expensive. It can be quite hard to translate what your vendor can provide towards others, because social media and social media analytics and content calendar planning and community management efficiencies are also subjective, because everyone has a phone. So I've been in this position where I always am trying to prove why we need it. And I had to prove how we needed it by showing how much work and time and moderation goes into doing it manually. But for some reason, because of how quick our turnaround was, it was like the perfect storm. And I just remember we were building these sheets of all of this amazing user-generated content, which is like one of my favorite things. And we would just tag it based off subjects, because I knew that at some point someone would be like, oh, I wish we had more content that was funny or feel good. And then we would just go back and find that content based off of tagging. So as long as you like do everything with intent and leave breadcrumbs for yourself, it is possible as long as you're willing to look at like the rawness of a sheet.
I'm wondering if you can tell us, or if you're willing to share, what did this project mean to you? Like Mike mentioned, it was during the height of COVID. Everything was uncertain, but we were all really busy making the show.
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk about it from a selfish professional perspective, and then I'll talk about it from like a selfless emotional perspective.
Sorry.
So selfishly, I had spent most of my career trying to convince people what you learn from your customer and consumer from social can be not only a content calendar, it can be a business objective driver, it can be content development, it could drive partnerships, it could drive revenue. And I always had to do it in piecemeal, where I'd be like, oh my God, I finally got this opportunity to show that one of the things that like community can provide you. And it was always an uphill battle to explain to individuals why I was important, why our role was important, or why my team was important. And it was always uphill. And then I get onto this team where like, you guys clearly know the value because you're working on it separately. John's team amazingly is asking for us to guide them and is willing to like let us work with them, which is so much easier said than done when it comes to people of not only that caliber, but that medium. Right away, we're working together. And very quickly, if anyone on any team was able to provide efficiencies or value, you know, they were welcomed with open arms. And I saw that all of these episodes were almost writing themselves, at least segment wise, not like entire episodic theme wise. And I was able to like knock on the door of clearly amazing, talented and collaborative people across all teams and say like, hey, guys, look what I found. And that affected partnership, revenue, and episode development. And it all happened at once. No one was making me like repeat myself 12 times and hold a seminar on why social media was important. So professionally, it was very fulfilling because level set, we were all on the same page. And I really wanted to impact episodes. Like I thought it would be really, really awesome to help with segments or help with talent. And I thought that that would be some like really hard to reach goal. And it happened overnight because of everyone's willingness to collaborate, not because I'm special in any way. So like that means the team was amazing. So selfishly, the team was everything I could ever ask for. And I think everyone every week got to watch the episode and be like, I did that, or I impacted that, or I found that segment. And that's just really powerful, and self-serving and vapid or not, it's powerful. And then selfishly. The opposite of selfish, selflessness. I mean, listen, like we're the ones reading all the positive sentiment. We're the ones watching the numbers, and we're watching the joy of all of our viewers in real time. And like, it was very powerful because like, here we are in the middle of like April, when it's like just now trying to decide, okay, this pandemic is way realer than we thought. This is what it means to be stuck at home. This is what it means to be unemployed or out of a job, or to be employed and now going to like a completely Zoom lifestyle. And it sucks. And here's this like thing that is providing me not only something I want to contribute to, but I also look forward to on a weekly basis. And you have doctors, teachers, students literally messaging you 24/7 saying how grateful they are. I mean, it felt really good. And very rarely am I able to work on something where the internet isn't telling me that I should just delete my handle and that it's a waste of time. So for better or for worse, some of these social platforms can be a little brutal. And this just was the opposite of that at a time when we needed it as professionals and they needed it as viewers. And it was just like encouraging and made me want to work harder. And it made me want to make episodes better.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way. I felt like it was crazy and busy, and we got to do some really cool stuff, but it was also kind of a saving grace during a time that would have felt really scary and depressing. We got to just dive headfirst into so much positivity and so many great, beautiful stories. So yeah, I feel the same.
Yeah, I feel like I could just relive this all day. It was a special experience indeed, but I wouldn't mind transitioning now to actually the main reason that we invited you on. We really wanted to hear more about the project that you did after Some Good News, which was called When We All Vote. And I think our audience can probably guess what it relates to, which is the US election. But can you just set it up for us, explain what it was, what the goal was, and how it went?
Yeah, absolutely. And it existed before the 2020 election, but due to like the convergence of everything that happened in 2020, it became really important and put into the spotlight. But pretty much there was a huge focus from When We All Vote around registering people who are not registered to vote. And typically those individuals, they were focused upon as minorities of various backgrounds who are either now able to register for the first time because of their age or never registered in the first place because of a lack of interest. So we're talking about pure participation from a bipartisan standpoint. So it didn't really matter what party you were affiliated with. For better or for worse, the US participation in the election, especially before this year, was always, it always could be better. You would see how many people participated and you're like, well, there's more people in the United States than that number. So pardon me, but like, what the hell is going on? So Michelle Obama and various people of her background decided to see if they could use their audience and their means to drive more interest and change the culture around voting registration. And coming from my background, which is consumer marketing, and while I was registered to vote, but not really like a participant in any way, there was a lot for me to gain from these individuals on like, what exactly is the Electoral College, or what are these terms, or what is gerrymandering, or like, what is the ability to vote? And then they were looking for me to help drive it from a cultural insights and analytics and performance marketing a la consumer marketing standpoint so that they could measure success accordingly. Because as of now, when I just started, you can register online always, but registering to a lot online became the utmost importance. You could always mail in your ballot always, but mailing in your ballot became the utmost importance from a safety measure and from a ability to get your vote counted correctly measure. So what we had is this entire world of politics go from registering in person, voting in person, towards like, that is not safe. And we need to figure out the correct way to educate everyone on how they need to do it, market how they need to do it. And for better or for worse, this is at a time when there's more disinformation happening than ever before, purposely. So we needed to not only inspire people to care, but then to register and then vote in a way where their vote could be counted correctly, no matter who they were voting for. It may seem like a while ago due to pandemic timeframes blurring, but at the thick of it, disinformation was at an all-time high. And I was just really excited for the challenge to work with clearly capable people on the political side and content marketing side to figure out what works and what doesn't to get people registered to vote, especially through online marketing.
So you shifted from a digital first strategy to a digital only strategy. And what did that actually look like in terms of messaging?
Yeah. So, I mean, I know that there may be people from the When We All Vote team eventually listening to this who could explain it to better, but I'm going to try my best here. So again, we've all seen how digital can be used to get people to do something offline. Like, we want you to buy this thing in person, or we want you to visit this concert, but you're purchasing the ticket online or you're being pushed down the sales funnel online. And that would always lead to maybe like experiential or some sort of grassroots or local campaign in the political world, or like getting you to vote in person, and you would measure based off voter ID if this person came through your funnel or not. And just during the pandemic, like, that just wasn't an option. We really didn't want to tell you to vote in person unless you had to, when you could mail it in ahead of time. You could register online. So like, you can not only drive people through digital marketing to get them to do what you thought was necessary, you eventually could get them to do it online through the only offline mechanism being dropping off your ballot in the mail. So anything that was planned from like a experiential local marketing, content marketing standpoint from like out of home, I don't think it ended completely, but it sure was curtailed overnight just due to the restrictions that we were dealing with. And these social media platforms became our above the line marketing mechanism. And this is at a time when interest of the election online not only from young people, but also adults in general, but also like the people running using this opportunity as above the line marketing as well, where it just became extremely saturated. And we really wanted to make sure that facts and actionable, tangible social content rose to the top.
So you mentioned social platforms. I want to spend a bit of time on that, because when you started to explain to us what When We All Vote was, for like the core purpose of it was really people that had never either one, expressed interest before in voting, or two, hadn't had the ability to vote, whether it was an age thing or even like an access thing. I'm curious, not just from social platforms that get the most engagement, but also with your audience in mind and reaching people that may typically be harder to reach or even harder to convince, what did the platform or channel strategy look like from your perspective?
So I would say over time, it became a very Instagram-first platform strategy, because when it came to reach, shares, and saves, which became my key focuses of measurement, because that would help me understand, are we reaching new audiences? Are we driving people to our bio who aren't registered in the first place to introduce them to the When We All Vote platform online? Instagram was like the clear winner. Also, because when we look at the talent partners that were participating, they were also providing the most power for us on Instagram. Twitter was a close second, but when it came down to just like really using educational content for the reason of like getting people registered, Instagram became the clear winner of how we viewed that.
What kind of educational content did you guys produce?
I want to give a minor backdrop to this. So I just distinctively remember a few years ago when Instagram stories and Instagram in-feed posts and video content became quite text-heavy, focused on numbers, statistics, or call to actions to get people to do something. And I was always wondering, like, not that I'm against its usage, but like, does this work? And what I saw very quickly with educational content that used facts about like how people voted in 2016 versus 2020, and what the outcome would have been if more people voted or not, again, not politics aside, but from a participation standpoint, or like definitions about all of the terms that Americans hear every 4 years or every 2 years, or what's on the line from a policy standpoint or from a law making standpoint, or how your vote affects everything from the House, the Senate, to women's rights, to the census. Instagram just gave the best opportunity to provide really tangible information that can be shared with other people quickly. That ways Twitter, unfortunately, at the time was providing us, but I just didn't think it was providing us with as much traction and as much reach as I thought Instagram was. So what we did is we would take a certain subject, whether it was state specific or term specific based off of a definition. And they had an amazing team at When We All Vote of social content creators and graphic designers and director level strategists figuring out what was of relevance at the time and what mattered towards like getting people towards November 3rd at what we thought would be the end date. And I would report based off what worked and what didn't and how people were responding to it. And then what was happening on the internet in worlds that are similar and trying to combine them to make recommendations. And I just noticed that what I had thought was maybe empty in the past was extremely powerful at this moment, where if I, Andrew, shared this post with Mitzi about the time I need to be registered by, and she ended up following When We All Vote, coming to our profile, clicking the link in the bio and sharing it with someone else, and Instagram will tell you this statistically, then like we can say that like educational content is growing our audience. And within education, these subjects grow our audience the most. And it just really helped us zero in on what became less of a focus on like, how can we chase culture from like a clout standpoint, and more just like, how do we inform everyone as much as possible so they can be empowered to make the decision they need to register to vote and vote for the person they see fit.
I want to read some stats that When We All Vote shared about the impact of their overall campaign. On Instagram alone, the content was shared 422,000 times and saved 74,000 times in the 100 days leading up to the election. And even better, 80% of the 20 most shared Instagram posts and 70% of the most saved posts focused strictly on educating voters and voter registration. That's an incredible reach, especially on Instagram, where a lot of brands are really struggling to do that. And obviously, it was such a strategic time during the election, but it kind of enforces that Instagram is the platform where you want to share content that can be easily saved and easily shared and something that people can use as a reference later. Can you share any other big wins that you saw at When We All Vote?
Yeah, so I'll speak a little bit more to those stats, because they blew my mind as I pulled them just as much as they probably blow people's mind as we read them. The number one shared post for all of When We All Vote happened on November 2nd, 20-ish hours leading up to the election. And it was like a list of states and the times you needed to be voting if you were going to vote in person at that point still, in line per state. So we're talking 50 state abbreviations, and then 100 different time frames, because each state had two different times in each. And that was shared, I think, like 70,000 something times on November 2nd. And like anywhere from 60 to 75% of the people who that content reached, like, did not follow us beforehand. And this is at a time when, like, you can only imagine how saturated feeds are with various forms of election day content. And it just really blew my mind, because it was just, here's something we need you to do if you are going to do it. And then later that day, we also shared the definition of your voting rights and what that entails when you're in line, and what is right and what is wrong, what happens when you're in line, because there was concern over how people would be treated when they were voting in line, whether they could be bullied or steered in the wrong direction. And that then beat out the other posts that same day to become like the first or second most shared post of all time, and reached 75% new audiences. Just shows we really, really provided people information they needed at a time they needed most, at a time where it was winning because of facts and information, not branding, not chasing clout. So that was really rewarding to me. And I think I would say it would probably be really rewarding to the entire team. And then another thing I want to point out is it kind of changed how I viewed influencer marketing, because we were taking all of our best performing educational content pieces and providing toolkits for the celebrity partners based off of what states they were from or what partners they were affiliated with. And we were like, hey, here's some of our best performing content. It's all fact checked. Feel free to share and participate as you see fit. And they started sharing our best performing fact-based information across their high follower count platforms. So you have these facts that are being amplified in the form of content coming from some of the biggest influencers in the world, and their face isn't even involved. It's just stats and facts about how people can participate. So that was really cool to me, because it was really influencer as a distribution mechanism for good. And it was just really exciting to see people participate that way. And as you can see by the numbers and by the end result of voting registrations, like, it really, really helped. And it just really made me feel that at a bare minimum, I was doing what I could do to contribute.
No kidding. Those are some serious statistics. That's so crazy. It's cool to see the wins, but I'm also curious, even going back to, again, the point that a big part of the audience were people that were previously uninterested in participating. I think some of that would likely be due to apathy, but some of it might be due to even polarized thinking, or also just disagreement or anger or anything. You know, I'm curious, knowing that that's the audience that you're targeting, what kind of resistance did you experience as you were sharing this content?
I would say that luckily, because it was bipartisan and we had so much support and volunteers trying to help us spread the message. I mean, if you really think about this election, this was like kind of the first time where brands and partners and celebrities, you know, musicians, athletes, tech companies, like, they all felt like they had a clear lane to help with voting registration. And luckily, our goal was so specific, like, get you registered. We don't care who you vote for. We just want you to get registered. I don't think this is something that should go overlooked. Like, luckily, I'm really good at ignoring the negative and dark side of the internet. Like, it was there. Like, we're talking about the 2020 election. Like, you don't need to dig far to realize how tumultuous it was. And our goals were so specific, and my analytics became so obsessed with just like educational content, reaching new audiences, saves, profile visits, link clicks. I think I just ignored it. I mean, it was probably rampant, but because we had such good partners and such clear focus, I mean, I was on Twitter during the election. Like, me saying it didn't exist is complete BS. I would say the resistance, and this was a really helpful thing that I feel comfortable talking about, trying to translate what success on social looks like for industries that are used to different measurements of success. I wouldn't call it resistance. I would just call it, like, luckily they were all so collaborative with me on helping me understand what they need. And we reached a breakthrough with just using the same analytics I would use for every other campaign performance and using different terms and different ways of presenting it in the marketing world of politics to show them this is what is working and why we should continue to invest time, effort, and resources in it. And I think that my advice would be, whether it's for politics, sports, entertainment, nonprofit, beauty, saying things like likes, comments, and shares may make sense to us, but presenting it in different terms could be the biggest difference between like breakthroughs or people never paying attention in the first place.
Can you dive into that a little deeper and maybe make it a bit more practical? Like, what would you recommend? I know we have so many social media managers listening to this, and maybe some of us get caught in the weeds and it feels like a cycle where every week or month or whatever, we're recording the same numbers over and over and over again, and they don't really tell a story. And I know this is kind of a curveball question, but do you have any other tips that you can offer on that side of things?
Yeah, I would say that, and this is on the fly too, but I could definitely make it tangible. So like, there are internal metrics that like we as social media professionals measure success. And then there are external metrics that like our clients or our bosses' bosses or cross-functional peers care about. So if I'm working super closely with a paid media team and all I'm talking about are likes and comments, I'm probably not going to get the most out of my relationship with them. So fortunately, on some of the teams I've been working on recently, what I noticed, especially with When We All Vote, is that not only educational content was doing well, and it was also introducing us to new audiences, it was literally moving people through the funnel. So if you go, I'll just be super blunt. If you go into Instagram's backend on the analytics side, it'll tell you the amount of people your content reached that do not follow you. And you'll notice that some have higher percentages than others. For us, educational content had the highest percentage by a landslide. So let's say this post drove 18% of the audience you reached did not follow you beforehand. Then 10,000 people came to your profile, and then 10,000 people followed you or clicked the link in the bio. I started to present that information as awareness, consideration, and conversion, because that is what paid media focuses on. So I would say, like, when the percentage of people we reached was high, I would be like, look at how much awareness this content drives. And then when their profile views came was high, I'd be like, and look at this consideration. And then when they followed us or clicked the link in the bio, that was conversion. So I'd say, look at all of this awareness, consideration, and conversion happening in this organic educational content. We should invest more in it, because it clearly moves people completely through the funnel at a time where it is saturated and there's a lot of competitors and a lot of disinformation out there. So it is worthy of paid media support. And then I would say, having that link click in the bio be trackable to tell you what Instagram content was driving everyone on the landing page to come there in the first place will only make that conversion tighter. So it's no different than the math that's there, but then I called it something else, i.e. awareness, consideration, and conversion. And then I think that alone either made the paid media team think I understood what they needed or helped them understand what I was sitting on. And very quickly, all these walls and barriers broke down. And I wouldn't call that resistance, but I definitely would call that any company that you work with, there will be subjectivity on the performance of social or the creative of social. And it is the social media professional's job to break it down and tailor it to them, especially if you have to break it down five different ways. It may not be fun, but the elbow grease is always worth it.
Man, that's so good.
So good.
I think, yeah, like Mitzi said, for the social media manager in the trenches or someone who's just kind of working for one brand exclusively and doesn't have a lot of exposure to other approaches or perspectives, this is such meaningful advice. As simple as it sounds, just the ability to translate the data that you're seeing into a digestible way that different groups or stakeholders understand, it's absolutely imperative. But while we're on the topic of advice, I'd like to know specifically if there's any tips you'd give to our listeners who may be involved in building a social campaign specifically for a politician or someone in the political sphere.
Okay, so I think I told you guys this before. I got very lucky with When We All Vote. It's my first and currently only experience in the world. So take what I say with a grain of salt. I would say this also applies to consumer marketing as well. Like negative sentiment, I think, is always ignored or you're scared of it because you're trying to avoid it. But like the amount of rich insights telling you what to do by telling you what not to do, especially what I imagine is more common on social and politics than consumer marketing, is some of the richest areas for insights. If you're on a brand or if you're in a campaign as a politician where like 90% of your conversation on Twitter is negative, which is always quite possible, then like, what are they being negative about? And is there something you can do about it? So the first thing I would say is like, lean into the bad if that's something that exists. Of course, if there's good, lean into it even more, but don't be afraid to learn what doesn't work, because that can really, really affect not only like content, but it could also affect like messaging at the campaign level for what's important to you. I would also say for politics and anyone who works in it, just like I kind of inferred, but like everything you would want to know about your demographics, the words they use, the jobs they have, their gender, their age, their family breakdown, you know, for better or worse, it's on social and it's right there for the taking. So instead of viewing followers as a number to achieve, view followers as like a complete breakdown of your audience. And I think audience development is something that politicians are going to be realizing is so, so powerful for who they want to talk to. Because with When We All Vote, what was really empowering for me is same thing with Some Good News. Like I read every comment, I read all the statistics, and I saw when we were either making people's day or hitting the exact target markets that we were trying to reach and getting positive results statistically or verbally. And that gave me the support I needed to continue to do what I do. You know, with Some Good News, it was easy. With When We All Vote, and I imagine in politics outside of an election, it's a grind and it's hard. So you can find, am I reaching the people that I want to reach? Am I developing the audience I want to develop by like obsessing over the comments, the followers, and the statistics and making it not only powerful for your content calendar, but powerful for your campaign and your messaging overall as well. And I think it's just really important to not ignore that while you're probably going through a big grind of producing content year round in the face of negativity and adversity.
That's great advice. Thank you so much. So you've been pretty lucky that you've been on a few projects like SGN and When We All Vote that have been heavily supported by celebrity endorsements. What impact does a celebrity factor have on a social program? And do you think that a campaign can go viral without one?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the impact is real. And sometimes it's not only for better, but it can be for worse. Sometimes we've all seen or been on campaigns where we're working with someone who may unfortunately deal with a hiccup and you either have to cancel the campaign or pivot the campaign. So I want to emphasize that the impact can not always be positive. I mean, I think depending obviously on the industry and the subject, there's a chance it will always help. But without it, I would not deter yourself from still obsessing over the culture that you're trying to navigate, the conversation that you're within, and realize that like you have just as much of a chance of going viral with or without that, because we've all seen a ton of celebrity campaigns, for better or for worse, do nothing as far as based off virality goes. So I would say that it always is a plus because of distribution and reach and immediate like ability or authority or trust. But like without it, I still think you have just as much of a chance, but maybe just a little bit farther down the totem pole of like how far along you are with getting to the end game of being either viral or successful. And we're also seeing that celebrity is becoming like almost a democratized term. So like, if you can't go after the A-list celebrity, like maybe you can go after other tiers of influencers, depending on how you measure the success of follower counts and content, and probably maybe not go viral, but have like a darn good objective driven business campaign where you reach your goals and are successful. And I think what people are realizing is that they could play in many ways with the term celebrity or without it and define success differently.
Boom. That's a good take, man. I just think it's like, it's a cop out for people to say that they need a celebrity to win. And it really just comes down to the value of the content. So thank you for that. I wanted to pivot a little bit before we start wrapping things up, but you and I actually share a love for sneakers and sneaker culture. And this is a bit of a throwback, but I couldn't let you go without talking about it. So I know you customized some Jordan 8s, and that was a bit of a thing. So can we just let our listeners know what that looks like, especially for the sneakerheads in the audience?
Yeah. So first and foremost, everyone has their thing. And my thing is sneakers. I like read about the industry. I love knowing about it from a business objective standpoint, like the math behind sales and then the culture behind it. So anytime I got a chance to work on an account or campaign affiliated with sneakers, I like really lunged for it and even was willing to do the dirty work. And when I didn't have those opportunities, I created them because I wanted to make sure that I was always positioned as someone who knew what was happening. And luckily, what we'll be talking about is the crying Jordan 8s. There's like four or five other things that just never made it to the forefront of being worthy on my resume. But I had a really good friend named Sherman, who's now a really high up creative director at VML YNR and super talented, shares the love for sneakers just as much as I do. And we were always kind of brainstorming behind the scenes of like what we would do if we worked on an account or what we would do if we did this with sneakers. And we kind of, through a brainstorm, realized that like this crying Jordan meme at its time was either laying the groundwork for memes in the future or was just like something that we could capitalize on the same way he may have done in his portfolio with spec work or I may have done with during the lockout and rating pantries on my resume. And we worked with a, I guess, patch designer to create a custom patch for the Jordan 8, which has like a fuzzy Jumpman logo patch on the tongue. We put that crying Jordan fuzzy patch on the tongue and created a custom graphically designed insole with the same logo. And at a bare minimum, I knew that I would put this for sure on my resume because it just shows that like, hey, even when I'm not working with sneakers, I'm working with sneakers. And like, it's important to me that people know that, especially if I'm interviewing for a footwear or apparel company. So we had a feeling we had something that could at least be popular amongst like Sneaker News, Kicks on Fire, and Complex. So we just like built a Tumblr, which I still believe exists today, made our pitch and sent it out to as many PR-driven type media publications based off who we think would care. We made an Instagram handle, started posting content about it. We shared it to our own Facebook pages. And at a bare minimum, I called it a success because it existed. Luckily, just due to the excitement around Michael Jordan and his crying Jordan meme, and we didn't know quite when and how we would launch it, but he had just started saying to people, hey, I'm all for you guys having fun with it, but if you try to make money off of it, I'm coming for you. I'm Michael Jordan. You know, don't mess with me and my lawyers. So we called it an art project because we wanted to make it super explicit that these were not for sale and they still were never exchanged for any transactions whatsoever. And it became, quote unquote, a viral moment for myself and Sherman, where featured on SportsCenter on television, featured across USA Today, featured across all of the blogs and editorial publications that we set out for it to be reached into the first place. And I had friends who worked at Nike at the time reach out to me and be like, we see this name and we are wondering if it's you. And I'm like, yeah, that's me. And they're just like, okay, well, like everyone at Nike is talking about this and, you know, it's all over the news and et cetera, et cetera. So we did a few interviews and we were very explicitly not ever going to sell it, even though we were offered large sums of money for it. And currently it's in an undisclosed location with my partner there, Sherman. And it was awesome. And I'll never forget it because I mean, I just kind of shows that like, and I'm still interested in working for footwear companies today. So if any are listening, hit me up. But like, it just shows you can turn side hustles into something more than just a side hustle. But no matter what, like if it was something I could have on my resume, obviously it helped that it did well. But like, I love sneakers. I got to work in it. I got to brainstorm around it. I got to ideate around it, and we got to create something. So like, I guess my biggest piece of advice there for anyone is they especially navigate social and marketing. You're not always going to be able to work on something that you're passionate about. But if you're ever at a company or if you're ever creatively inspired to work in that Venn diagram, it will pay off because you just like naturally give 150% and it feels good, which is why I even remember working on a female focused footwear brand. And I made flashcards for dress shoes, made flashcards for wedges, and like understood how this like product line works. And like, I'm never going to wear these shoes, but I had just as much fun, which just shows you how much fun I possibly had on the crying Jordan 8s.
Seriously. So with all that in mind, where's your sneaker design career going next?
I got none, man. We thought about doing another one, like, but we all know that like when lightning strikes, sometimes you strike twice or sometimes you let it ride off into the sunset. I would say if someone were to be like, Andrew, what's your dream job? I would say I would love to just like obsess over footwear and consumer research about footwear and like help people understand what types of shoes they should create next and let the designers and architects do their things. You can go study a hashtag right now for Air Force One and learn everything you want about a consumer and help have it inspire, you know, product development now. And that's something I'd love to do. So maybe that's where I see my sneaker design phase going.
Love it.
That's amazing. Okay, so we're nearing the end here. And before we let you go, we like to ask all of our guests this question. Who's making waves right now and why?
Yeah, obviously I could open the door to a whole amount of conversation around consumer marketing and entertainment. But I kind of want to talk a little bit more about what I learned about the way people can operate within like civic engagement and activism. I think we're now seeing that with Gen Z's literal interest of using social media for good. I mean, if you look at statistics within the 2020 election, like young people just showed up and it inspired everyone else to participate in ways that just did not happen before. I mean, I don't want to sound like a cop out, so I will dive deeper into this, but like, I just remember being so blown away with like the literal participation from a digital, online, and offline point of view from Gen Z and how much they cared. So what I did is I started exploring like all of these different handles that just take super complex subjects and break it down for social and like Instagram carousels or TikToks, or now even on, you know, the audio world of like Clubhouse and Discord, where people are willing to use social media in ways that are not just for entertaining purposes, but like almost like infotainment purposes. And you see those Instagram carousels where you're like, oh, I just learned about a subject that I had never learned about before from like Instagram handles such as like So You Want to Talk About or Zenerations or anything along those lines, where they're just like, all right, well, like everyone cares about these subjects more than ever. Yes, Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and TikTok can provide awesome forms of mindless entertainment, which I am all for. I sit on my couch and FUB a lot too. But if you're interested, you can literally learn more about very complex subjects that involve civic engagement, activism, you know, science, math, you name it. And we're clearly seeing, I mean, like with TikTok using a partnership with Quizlet to provide you with more ways of integrating learning into their platform, or with just like those Instagram carousels that teach you about a subject that, you know, you may not be an expert, you can definitely talk about it now. I just think that like educational content, and especially because of the interest from Gen Z, is making waves right now.
So good. Okay, for the last and final question, we love to ask, what are you currently working on and where can listeners connect with you?
Awesome. Yeah, so the easiest way I would say right now to connect with me is LinkedIn. I'm very open to mentorship opportunities or informational interviews or networking in any capacity. So please feel free to hit me up there and I'll definitely respond. And if I don't respond, follow up, because that always helps and I welcome it. I'm currently consulting across a ton of entertainment and sports properties, again, with a focus on social and digital strategy and audience development. And what I'm seeing, which is super exciting, is again, that social is becoming a not only above the line form of marketing, but a premier place for research and learning and audience development and insights. And through that, the platform is continuing to change, whether it's the players of Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn that we know about, and then obviously TikTok as well, but also up and coming forms of social such as audio within Clubhouse, Discord, and anything else that I haven't even mentioned yet. So I think the one thing that I really love about what I do is I'm literally not allowed to get comfortable. And I always have to evolve how I present information, how I consume information. And luckily, I love entertainment and they love the types of services I provide because of their obsession with audience and insights and streaming and watching, developing content based off of that, that I'm finding that it's something that I really enjoy doing long term.
Cool. Well, man, I hope you're ready for people to just hit you up on LinkedIn because this has been some really valuable conversation and I'll be looking for you. We're going to come up with some sort of sneaker collab that we can work on together because it's just time to do it.
Dude, do it. I want to. I'll tell you the idea that didn't make it. We always wanted to do a barbecue themed Nike Air Monarch because of just like how powerful they are in the world of fathers and PE teachers.
How did that not make it?
How did that not make it? I think it's been done, or the Monarch is just like this like weird...
Just untouchable?
It's untouchable. It like does its work. And if you mess with it, it probably fights back and shuns you.
Love it. All right. We'll take that offline, but it's going to be fun. And our listeners have a lot to look forward to. Thanks for joining us. We're probably going to end up with a follow-up chat on Clubhouse because that's what we do. And we know that you're probably already an influencer on that platform at this point. So thanks for joining us here today.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. It was really awesome catching up with y'all and talking about these things.
This episode of Wave Social Podcast is powered by Arcade Studios. Show notes for this episode and other episodes can be found at wavesocialpodcast.com. You can also subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you've got questions, comments, or suggestions for future shows, hit us up at Wave Social on Instagram. Thanks for joining us.